Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
This episode is brought to you by Healthbird. Are you in search for the perfect health insurance? Well, look no farther, because they are the ultimate platform that revolutionizes the way that you find, enroll, and manage your health coverage. Healthbird offers an innovative solution that is tailored just for you. They have a lightning-fast search engine that you can effortlessly compare health insurance quotes in milliseconds. There's no more tedious hours of browsing endless websites or spending hours on the phone with insurance agents. They offer a user-friendly app available on iOS and Android, which puts the power of managing your health insurance right at your fingertips. So again, you know, don't let the complexity of health insurance overwhelm you. Join Healthbird community and experience a seamless, intuitive platform that puts you in control. So get a quote today at healthbird.com/dealmakers. This episode is brought to you by Bupos. Attention, entrepreneurs. Are you ready to take your business aspirations to new heights? Allow me to introduce you to Bupos, the ultimate solution for finding and funding your SaaS and subscription-based business acquisitions. With Bupos, you'll experience a seamless and worry-free process. They offer flexible funding and require absolutely no personal guarantee. I mean, again, you can go there, you can explore over 1,000 opportunities pre-approved for financing, ensuring that you invest in a business with true profit potential. Bupos has got you covered. Their team actually provides one-on-one advisory support to help you making informed decisions. And on Bupos, you got to remember, they've already approved over $700 million in funding, and they've written over 3,000 businesses, financed hundreds of successful business acquisitions, and have an impressive 4.7 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot. So you should go to bupos.com/dealmakers, and that is Bupos as bupos.com/dealmakers. Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an exciting founder, a serial entrepreneur that has done it. Now he's on his third company, and very successfully so. We're going to be learning quite a bit on all the lessons learned, on the challenges that he faced from building a business in South America versus building a business now in Europe, which is obviously different challenges that he had, you know, in front of him. But again, you know, super inspiring for all of you who are listening, who perhaps, you know, are also in the same journey of building something that is exciting. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Philip Powell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show today.
So originally born in Brazil, obviously, you know, it was between Brazil and Germany where you were raised. But give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Life was good, at least at the very beginning. You know, in Brazil, it was also pretty sunny until I moved to Germany, I guess. I was born in Brazil, in São Paulo, you know, Brazil's largest city, in the early 80s. And then at the beginning of the 90s, basically, my parents decided to move back to Germany, which was naturally a big cultural shock for me and also temperature shock, but it was great. I had an amazing childhood with lots of friends and also lots of brothers and sisters. And, you know, I think I took away the best that I could from both cultures.
Now, that's a big move. That's a big move. Obviously, completely different cultures too. And you were 8. You know, at that point, you know, you really realize, you know, what's going on. So, you know, obviously, new friends, new places, you know, lots of uncertainty. How do you think that shaped who you are today?
That's a good question. I mean, I never really thought so much about this. I guess, you know, you're kind of used to, you know, having to adjust to new environments, right? So you're kind of used to having to reflect on your own actions and how that also might be perceived by other people. And so I think I've become a person that, while I might not project this, constantly question myself, how I do things and how I can improve myself. And I think that's also something that I've taken into the business and the way that I try to, you know, actually do business with people from around the world. Yeah? I think in today's world where everything is changing extremely fast, people like to call it the VUCA world, it's probably one of the most essential skills that you can have to constantly adjust, constantly question yourself, being humble and being open to learning.
Now, for you, how did you get this drive for entrepreneurship? I mean, was it something that you were born with? Was it something that, you developed, you know, over the course of time? Did you have anyone in the family? You know, how did you get inspired, you know, for, you know, building and scaling stuff?
I was born into a family of entrepreneurs, I would say. My father, he was a business owner. His father was a business owner. And as a consequence of this, you're basically raised also with friends of the family that are business owners. So I really never knew anything different. I always felt it was the right thing to do to build a business. I always wanted the freedom that comes with it, the intellectual challenge that also comes with it, to extend also the diverse scope of the work that you need to fulfill also as an entrepreneur. I love the competition and, you know, to be transparent, I also love the financial prospects of a great business or what it can represent. And so for me, it was always a natural path, but it wasn't the first thing I did, right? So I've always been very numbers and science driven. I'm a very rational person. And so after studying economics and then actually moving over to business administration, I actually didn't go into entrepreneurship, but I started to work in investment banking at JP Morgan. And the reason I did this was because my father had died and I had this need for safety, security. And, you know, that was basically in 2007. And then I moved into investment banking. To be fair, in hindsight, it's probably the worst move you could have done in 2007 is to move into investment banking to be in a safe industry. But I think I was lucky. I joined JP Morgan. It was a very good investment bank with great learning and also a company that navigated super well through the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009. And after having that learning, for me, it was the right time to build a business. And I did that basically starting 2009 built my first business called My Brands at that time.
And the quick question there, because I see and I come across a lot of founders that have either been on the investment side, private equity or venture capital or consulting or investment banking, you know, and there's some pattern there, you know, on some of those that they come on and are pretty successful, you know, that have had those backgrounds. How do you think that the background in investment banking helped you, you know, later on as you were building and scaling companies?
I guess in my case, there are probably two things. The first thing probably is the fact that I've always thought very hard about macro trends and about what I like to call mega trends, because that's what you do when you invest or allocate your capital, right? You have to think about trends, asset allocation, how businesses function, and market dynamics. And that is something that I've taken with me. I'm a strong believer in investing my time in secular tailwinds and things that will work over a longer period of time. And that is something that I definitely learned also in investment banking. And there's a second aspect to it. I was for a short period of time in sales. And in sales, you start thinking very hard about equity stories and how you sell and how you pitch. And that is something that I always think very hard about, right? Because it's one thing is your execution and you know, how you actually build a business. But you need to sell your business constantly, not only to people that you hire, but also to investors. And we need to raise funds. And that's probably something I learned also during my tenure at JP Morgan and how to do that. And at least that has served me well during that time.
So at what point did you feel that, because I mean, you were for quite a little bit, you know, there in JP Morgan and doing the different gigs that you did in investment banking, but at what point did it feel right, you know, the right time for, you know, taking a leap of faith and giving the notice and going at it?
I mean, it felt right. I mean, let's be fair. Yeah, at that time, investment banking was probably slightly different from what it is today. It was a time where the work hours were crazy. I didn't really have a lot of time to reflect at that time. You know, I got up at 5:30 in the morning. At some point, I was working in trading and also doing some stuff for Asia. And going home quite late. So I didn't have a lot of time to reflect. But at a certain point, you feel like, okay, this is probably not it and not what I want to do in the long term. And I had seen some of my friends building businesses successfully. And this is something I always wanted to, and also probably came more from an inner feeling of security. I felt it was the right moment to take a leap of faith. And then I decided to do it. As I pointed out, my father had died a few years earlier, and you know, that was to some extent digested. And then I was willing to run some risk and do it. But, and also, to be fair, when you are 26, 27, you have an education, you don't have huge debt. You know, building a business is not a big risk from my perspective. You don't have a lot of responsibility except for, you know, doing your best. And that's what I tried to do at that time.
So why my brands? You know, out of everything that that you could do, why my brands felt like the, you know, first business that you wanted to tackle?
I wish I had a very sophisticated answer to that, that I'd done, you know, tremendous market research. It was just an opportunity that fell into my lap. I had spoken to my co-founder at that time, who was looking into that business. For me, it was a good entry point into that. I liked the fashion space. My family had been in fashion, in the fashion business before. But I must say, my family always told me, don't go into fashion. That's a business that is dying. At least that was a feeling at that time. And, you know, for me, it was a step into entrepreneurship, a step into learning. And you know, I was invested into internet and e-commerce as a whole, and not necessarily into the specifics of that particular model at that time.
So Zalando, at what point does Zalando come knocking? At what point does Zalando come into the picture? Because, I mean, obviously, first company, first exit, you know, is amazing. You know, the odds are always against you, especially because you don't have that visibility, you know, as a first-time founder, so that you perhaps have now as a third-time founder, where you've seen the full cycle of how a business, you know, starts, you know, raises, scales, and then exits. So what kind of visibility did this give you on that full cycle, and how did it happen with Zalando?
So an exit always sounds beautiful and shiny. But in that case, I would say it was an exit, and I wouldn't particularly celebrate that exit hugely, right? So I think for us, it was a strategic outcome that was possible at that time. We saw a lot of competition popping up, and we felt it was necessary to go that path, right? And we knew the founders of Zalando. We started engaging with them, and they also saw some value in us because they were also starting to engage into the off-price business with Zalando Lounge. And that was a natural fit. It wasn't a very long process. It was something that basically took a few weeks to be completed and also drafted. But it was an important step because we learned a lot in that process, not only because of, you know, the sale process itself, but also the strategic aspects of that acquisition to Zalando. And also we were able to learn a lot with Zalando, which we then later on used in order to build our business in South America, right? That was for us probably the point at which we, you know, we said, okay, this is an amazing business. It's better than what we were doing. And the reason we came to that conclusion were a few nuances, right? Which I think sometimes go unnoticed. It sounds crazy when I say, you know, a fashion outlet, an online fashion outlet is fundamentally different from a fashion e-commerce. Superficially speaking, you could say it's just the discounts. But that wasn't it, right? There are many, many more aspects to it that are different. In particular, the market dynamics with your supplier base, how you source them, what kind of value they perceive in you. It also has huge implications on your cash conversion cycle and things like this. And, you know, this was the moment that I was able to see all of that, right? And I guess that's also something that really allowed me to become a better founder over the course of time. Because the truth is, I haven't always just done well, right? We've also struggled. My brands was an exit. It was a successful exit, but it wasn't a huge exit. And to some extent, it was also the result of some strategic challenges that we had. And, you know, that is something that also accompanied us across this, you know, many, many years afterwards. And so, you know, I think we learned a lot from that. And that is something that made us better founders.
So the transaction happens, and then you decide that it's time to pack the bags and go to Brazil. So walk us through what was the thought process there.
A bit more sophisticated than my brains. As you know, I was I'm Brazilian, and I always had those great memories from my childhood. Not only the weather and the beach, but you know, when you're small, you always remember the nice things. After selling basically my brands at Zalando, I felt it was time for a new adventure. And in 2010, we basically decided to go there. And I'm not sure you remember, Alejandro, but Brazil was on the cover of The Economist at the end of 2009. And the title basically said, Brazil takes off. Brazil was really hot. It had won the nomination to host the FIFA World Cup in 2014, had won the nomination to host the Olympics in Rio in 2016. Those are just symbols of the success. The underlying drivers of this were that Brazil had become economically extremely strong. More than 60 million Brazilians had stepped out of poverty into an inspiring middle class. Brazil was on the top of the world, at least in terms of perception, right? And then I started to dive into some of the specifics of the fashion market, which is actually one of the largest fashion producing markets in the world. At the same time, nobody was selling fashion online, and I knew what the potential was also in the US and Europe. And it kind of felt like a no-brainer. And at that time, it felt like the odds were against us because a lot of people in Brazil said, you know, nobody does it. Why people want to touch the goods? People don't trust the internet, et cetera, et cetera. But it turned out all right, I guess. So the Fiji became in the years 2011 and 2012. So basically the first 2 years of operations became one of the fastest growing e-commerce companies, not just in Latin America, but on the entire planet, and a huge success.
So you guys ended up taking the company public, but I guess for the people that are listening to get it, I mean, what were you guys doing at Davichi and also at Davichi there, you know, like what was the, how are you guys making money?
Yeah, good question. So we started Davichi in Brazil, and Davichi is basically, and still is by the way, a fashion e-commerce company and marketplace. The value proposition is relatively simple. We offer an inspirational shopping experience, a vast and relevant portfolio, a high level of convenience, and fair and accessible prices. And that allowed us basically to grow from zero to a business that generated hundreds of millions of GMV in Brazil and later on in other countries. In 2012, we started to expand into other geographies in Latin America. We went to Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Mexico. Mexico was eventually sold off, but all the other businesses still continue. And Davichi is today one of the largest fashion e-commerce in Latin America.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So what was the process of taking the company public? I mean, prior to taking the company public, you guys raised quite a bit of money. How much did you raise prior to the acquisition?
Good question. I would have to dig deep, but it was several hundred million euros at that time. And to be fair, we would have to look at the entire group since after founding Defici, I think it was about 2015, we decided to merge also with other fashion businesses across the globe. In Southeast Asia, Australia, India, and also the Middle East. And so the funding was quite substantial at that time. Some of those businesses were later on sold off, but we still went public in 2019 on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange with the businesses in Southeast Asia, Australia, also Russia, which I forgot, apologies for that, and the Middle East. Yeah. And, you know, we went public as a group. We basically built headquarters in London and Luxembourg decided basically that 2019 was the right year. I'm not sure you remember, but 2018-19 saw quite a few tech IPOs, in particular also in the e-commerce space, some of those quite successful. And this is when we started to go out. We had seen, you know, the business improve substantially with quite a few of our markets already being profitable, being cash flow positive, by the way, including also Defici in Latin America. And this was a strong indication that the group as a whole could become a viable business. And this was the moment when we basically went out and successfully IPO'd the business in 2019.
And what was the reasoning, you know, behind all these mergers that you guys did, and what did you learn about M&A, but more on the buy side or on the merger side?
Well, as usual, you learn the hard way how mergers work, right? And that wasn't the first one. We actually had acquired also two companies before in Brazil, Canoe and Tricai. You PowerPoint basically tells you one thing, reality tells you a different one. And it's always very hard, in particular from a cultural perspective, to make the teams work together. And realize the kind of business synergies that you want to realize to justify that kind of deal and the prices that you've paid. But in the case of the global merger that we had between the different businesses, there was a stock transaction. And I guess the hardest learning that we had there is that, you know, communicating across the globe is quite different, and leveraging synergies is also not that easy. But we did manage to do quite a few, right? Especially around purchasing, tech collaboration, and also just best practice sharing, and how you also evolve your value proposition across certain geographies. You see what one country is testing and working out, you apply that learning into your geography. So there's a lot of stuff you can do. Naturally, economies of scale are something that are very difficult to capture when you're operating across the globe. But that is something that we learned definitely during that time.
So at the peak of the market cap of the company was well over 3 billion. Now, after the pandemic, you know, after such a successful run, you know, with Defici, you decide that it's time to step down. What happened there? And then what led you, you know, to Mondo?
Well, I mean, those years were extremely tense of the pandemic. I think people look at e-commerce of this time and think, it was smooth waters. Demand just shifted digitally, but it was actually quite stressful. We were a stable, profitable business before the pandemic hit. The first reaction at the pandemic wasn't that people were shifting demand 100% to digital. It was actually the opposite, especially on something as a discretionary good as fashion. As a matter of fact, demand collapsed by about 70 to 80% as a reaction of the pandemic. That was the first thing that happened. And then all of a sudden, consumers started to shift behavior to the digital sphere. And then things started to turn out quite nicely for us, right? So in 2020 and then also 2021. But it was an extremely stressful time. And after navigating that, let's be honest, you know, we were thinking, you know, wow, if demand collapses by 80%, you know, how will we fund the business? How are we going to do that kind of stuff? We had, huge working capital commitments. But after things turned out very nice for us, it came to the moment we say, okay, we're profitable, we're generating cash. Market cap is at its max at that time. It feels like the right moment to step down. We had done this, and when I say we, it's also my current co-founder, Malte, and I. We had done this for more than 10 years. We had accomplished our growth plans. We've become a profitable business. And after so many years, you feel like a new challenge. Also for family reasons, I wanted to move closer to Europe and do something else. The decision that I took was not, okay, I want to do something that I believe is a bigger opportunity. It was like, I just want to do something else and also in a different scenery, in a different space. And that's when I decided basically to step down at the beginning of 2021, also with my co-founder Malte, and move back to Germany. And the move to Germany was more really for family reasons than anything else. Why Mondo, right? So we wanted to do something naturally that allows us to leverage our extensive experience in e-commerce as well as tackle a meaningful problem. I talked about this before when I said, okay, my learning from investment banking is that invest your time in big trends, right? And that was something that we were looking into. So we very quickly, following many discussions with, companies, VCs, etc., we came to the conclusion there are very few markets that are as massive as the B2B payment markets. And at the same time, it is a market that hasn't seen really significant innovation, nor to speak disruption for the last 20 to 30 years. It's a market, not sure you're aware, it's a market that transacts about $125 trillion per year. And which has processes that it remain pretty stable for a long period of time. And the main reason it is a stable market is that B2B, contrary to B2C, involves many, many stakeholders. It's much, much more complex. Every company is different in each market. Companies of different sizes have different processes, different compliance requirements. And so in order to be successful, you need to have very tailored solution for every company. What is changing now is that business to business transactions is moving into the physical, to the digital sphere, right? So you see businesses adopting more financial SaaS, which provides an entry point for innovation from our perspective. And we believe that that entry point for us is deferred payment. And the reason for that is that businesses, and that's been the case for the last 5,000 years, transact through net terms, right? So when you own a store, you don't buy your goods paying in advance. You buy that in order to protect your cash and to optimize your working capital, paying in 30 days, 60 days, sometimes even more. And the problem with that is that this typically works super well when you have a long-standing relationship, when you have a face-to-face encounter, but in the digital sphere, it doesn't work. And what we saw is that there's a need for that, in particular within B2B e-commerce. And then the question is, okay, how big is B2B e-commerce? And it turns out it is actually four times the size of B2C, which I was quite surprised to find out because I was a merchant in the B2C space for more than 10 years. It is a market that is 20 trillion in size compared to about 5 trillion in B2C. And it is a market that is extremely fragmented and hasn't also seen the kind of infrastructure being developed to the extent that has been the case in the B2C space. And so we decided basically to build, you could say, an embedded deferred payment solution company. And the starting point was B2B BNPL, but we're going way beyond that with Mondo.
Now, with Mondo, you guys have also raised some money. So how much have you raised? And then also, what did you look for in the investors that you brought in? Because obviously now, third company, you've now raised in the past. So what were you really looking, from them?
Now, So we raised in 2021, we raised our series seed round. We raised at that point about 12 million euros from FinTech Collective and Cherry Ventures, as well as a few very famous angel investors from Klarna, Zalando, SumUp, and you know a few other guys. At that time, what was important for us is to look for partners, right? And that has been true also throughout the Series A funding that happened last year around May. We raised at that time a Series A round led by Valar of about now, including also the top up, 52 million euros. I think this makes it the largest Series A in fintech in Germany of 2022. So in total, we've raised more than 64 million euros of equity in less than 2 years, right? So that was in basically 1.5 years. And on top of that, we raised also some significant debt financing in order to finance also our debt facility and our SPV structure. What I always look for in investors is actually a partner, right? I've been doing this now for a long time, and I know that being an entrepreneur isn't a straight line. It isn't easy, and everybody who's built a business knows that you will struggle and things might get difficult. And what I want is somebody that understands that, somebody that is going to have my back when things get tough. And I knew basically the three funds for a very long time. I've known FinTech Collective for a few years. I had actually met them before the pandemic. I love the guys. Besides being, you know, FinTech expert in something that I definitely could learn more about, at that time, you know, are, you know, super fun, to be with. And I think, you know, given their background also in as entrepreneurs were something that we felt was the right fit. Same thing with Cherry Ventures. Cherry is a VC built by people that built businesses before. We've known them for a long time. Actually, we've been friends also for a long time. It just felt right. And they've been super supportive all along. And the Valar guys, we have also known for a long time. We've met them actually in Brazil probably 10 years ago. We went out for dinner, and so that felt like a natural natural fit. And I think this is extremely important in the initial phase of a startup when you're still trying to figure some things out, look for somebody that has your back and that is your partner. Later on, of course, other things also become important, but at this stage, this was what we were looking for.
Now, when it comes to raising money too, there's vision. Vision that needs to be shared and in a way that is compelling for these folks that are jumping in to share the journey with you. No? So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world, Philip, where the vision of Mondo is fully realized, what would that world look like?
Well, I mean, to work backwards and speak from a customer perspective, and that means basically businesses would have a much easier way of transacting and getting the kind of working capital support that they need, right? I've been in a business before that does working capital, needs a lot of working capital, and sometimes I always want to know why do I need to provide that kind of prepayment? Why is it so difficult to get those goods? Why do I need a credit insurance and that kind of stuff? And that is our vision. To turn this a bit more tangible, we want Mondo to become the deferred payment option along all this, the payment steps of business to business transactions that starts with order management, what we're doing right now, which people call BNPL. It continues with accounting system, treasury systems, procurement system, expense management systems. What we do can be embedded everywhere. It doesn't just have to be in order management. And this is what I tried to say, right? So every company has different needs, and we need to find a way to plug in our services at the point that they can access it. And it's just not one solution. We need to become a Swiss Army knife. And that is ultimately our vision, right? To become this Swiss Army knife that facilitates business-to-business transactions and makes just allows businesses to focus on what really matters, which is, you know, to improve their value proposition, grow the business, and be financially sound.
So now let's talk about the past, but with a lens of reflection. You know, obviously now you've been at it for three times, you know, a founder, you know, two times, you know, already that you were able to achieve a liquidity event, whether it was via an acquisition or via going public. So you've learned a lot, you know, over the past years. So imagine I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back to that moment where you were working at JP Morgan, you know, and you're able to put yourself right there, you know, next to that younger Philip, and you're able to give that younger Philip one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Ooh, quite a few things, I guess. One thing is probably that's the easiest thing you can do is just talk to as many people as you can, and ideally with people that are smarter than you. That's actually surprising, a lot of things to learn. And I think people sometimes assume that others are not willing to share their pain and their learnings. And that's not the case, right? So if I probably had spoken to more people, I could have avoided certain mistakes that I made. And rather ask too many times for help than thinking that this is a problem you need to solve alone. That is something that I definitely learned. And the other one is probably a very technical recommendation. You know, I've gone through a pretty rigid financial education at university and afterwards also at JP Morgan. And to some extent, I felt after I started my business that I don't need to potentially think of certain aspects, right? So, and I can be a bit more concrete about this, right? So you really need to understand not just the output of your business, you know, meaning revenue, profit, et cetera, and cash flow, but you need to actually understand the underlying drivers of the business. So not just the output, but the input KPIs. That's how we like to call it. It's also a lot of other businesses do it like this. This sounds obvious, and you would argue that most young companies do this. But as a matter of fact, my experience is that most people focus on the output, right? Not so much on the input. They don't focus on leading indicators that are indicative of what will happen in the future, such as, for instance, customer net promoter score, right? Or how your portfolio is built. All the kind of details are really giving you an indication of what needs to improve and what your results will be in the future, right? I would argue that most founders don't think in detail about the balance sheet. It sounds kind of off at the beginning, but if you think about this, you naturally think also about business dynamics, cash conversion cycle, and other things. And then the other thing is probably, and this is also common learning, but I also had to learn the hard way, you know, do little steps, iterate and learn faster, do more iterations. And that is something probably that I could have done better over the course of time. But this comes naturally to nowadays, this is probably a more common term. When I started about now 14 years ago, it wasn't that common, at least. Yeah.
Amazing, Philippe. So for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Probably the best way is through LinkedIn. Happy to connect, happy to share some of my learnings. Also happy to get new customers at Mondo, right? So if you own a B2B e-commerce company or any kind of business that wants to transact with others in the digital sphere, reach out to us. Open for business.
Amazing. Well, hey, Philippe, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.